Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the third week of February. This week, we are very pleased to have Ron Sykes as our guest, here to speak with us about wildlife habitat and what you can do to improve it in your very own backyard. Welcome, Ron.
Hello, Deborah.
Ron has been active with our local Audubon chapter, Admiralty Audubon, for a long while, and he and his wife, Rosemary, have been involved with wildlife habitat enhancement for over 20 years in our area. So we are greatly looking forward to picking his brain on this topic. But before we get to that, let's hear the mystery sound of the week. One of the perks of being a guest on our program is that you are given the option of choosing the mystery sound. This lovely sound was Ron's choice, and he and I will tell you what it is and talk about what made him choose it towards the end of the program. First of all, I would like to congratulate my fellow Nature Now colleagues on our 300th show. We really should have done a special joint show this week to celebrate. It seems unbelievable that we've been at it for this long, but we continue to learn and get great guests in, like Ron, to share cool information about the amazing natural world around us. Our special thanks to our original producer, Kate Dwyer, whose brainchild this show was 5 years ago.
Bob Sundstrom is the lead writer for the great radio program Bird Note out of Seattle. He's posted some observations on the UW's Twitter site. This morning on Valentine's Day, we watched two male tree swallows gliding over our field and landing on a couple of swallow nest boxes. This is the earliest date we've seen tree swallows arrive in nearly 15 years of keeping records here, although we've seen them as early as February 17 and 18 in other years, but some years, not until March the 5th. Also, a robin was singing from the top of a conifer before sunset tonight, the first full robin song I've heard this year. Quote, Bob lived just south of Olympia, so keep your eye peeled for tree swallows arriving in your own backyard soon.
I also heard black-capped chickadees and Hutton's vireos singing a few days ago. What new birds have you been seeing and hearing out there this past week, Ron?
Bjork's wren, robins are singing their territorial song, and of course, song sparrows.
Oh, that's great. I know it's such a great time of year. They're all starting to ramp up. In other signs of spring, I saw the first brilliant magenta blossom fully exposed on a salmonberry bush a few days ago, and I have started to see rough-skinned newts crossing the road. It's time to slow your car way down and start watching for these adorable amphibians as they make their slow march across the roads to their breeding ponds. The move is triggered by the increase in humidity and temperature, and the newts are especially hard to see against a gravel or paved road, as their backs are dark brown seen from above. It's only from the underside that their bright orange alarm coloration is visible.
This week is also National Invasive Species Awareness Week, and the Washington State Invasive Species Council just provided us with some fancy new ammunition in the invasive species battle. One of the major problems has always been knowing who you should tell if you reel in a strange fish, find a new plant taking over in your yard or local park, or spot a strange insect in your firewood. Figuring that out just got easier with an update app just out last month. That lets you report unusual sightings on your smartphone or computer. Within a few minutes of sighting an invasive species, a photograph, a geographic coordinates, and sightings information can be entered and made available immediately with an automated alert to the council and its network of experts.
It's a quote, this streamlined process will enable invasive species managers in Washington State to more quickly respond to new invasive species sightings, unquote, said Justin Bush, executive coordinator of the Washington Invasive Species Council. When it comes to successfully eradicating invasive species, early detection and a rapid response is key, unquote. Isn't this an exciting innovation? Go to rco.wa.gov for a link to download the app. invasive species and noxious weeds often outcompete native plants and animals and result in costs of more than $137 billion annually in the U.S. alone through crop damage and fisheries and forest health impacts. When we speak about wildlife habitat, people tend to think about state or federal lands, but it is possible to do a lot for wildlife right in our own backyards, right?
When you think about the huge area that's impacted by meeting our needs and the fact that we live in some of the best climate zones and on some of the best soils, then you have to realize there's a great potential for creating rich habitats for wildlife in our backyards.
I was reading a great article put out by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife's Living with Wildlife Division, which started by introducing the four basic needs for wildlife: food, water, shelter, and space. Perhaps we should start by talking about the best potential food sources for wildlife in our area.
The top of the list surely must be insects and other invertebrates such as earthworms, nematodes, centipedes, and isopods.
All of those squiggly things that people don't really want to talk about are actually great food sources.
Small mammals such as bats, shrews, moles, even flying squirrels depend wholly or partially on these invertebrates. And all the songbirds and many large birds can only sustain their young by feeding them a diet of insects. Many adult songbirds almost exclusively eat insects and other invertebrates. So if we are going to provide habitat for birds and small mammals, then we have to provide habitat for the insects and other invertebrates.
Probably the most important thing to do is provide a good mix of plants that produce flowers and seeds and fruit and insects at different times of the year, right? What would you suggest for starters in our area?
Let me say that I would suggest your first choice be native plants because of the symbiosis that native plants have with their host insects and other invertebrates. And for a good discussion of this, I would recommend you read Bringing Nature Home by Professor Doug Ptolemy, where he and his students have actually done some studies on native versus introduced plants when it comes to beneficial native insects.
Because they've adapted together.
Yes, this adaption often takes geological time in order for the insects to actually be able to eat the plants in some cases. Plants, on the other hand, are producing poisons to keep from being eaten. But when we bring a plant here from somewhere else, we've left that plant's insects behind.
What other favorite plants do you suggest for wildlife in our area?
If you have your acreage, then you can consider the larger trees like Douglas firs and other native conifers. The Pacific madrone, it produces a huge crop of nectar on its bearing flowers, and then it has lots of fruits eaten by fruiting birds like the bantail pigeon. Requiring a lot of space and sun is the Geary oak, and it's known for its crop of wildlife attracting acorns and the nest holes for cavity nesting birds. For a one or two lot landscape, some suggested conifers would be noble fir, mountain hemlock, and shore pine, and these trees will grow slow enough and stay small enough. They're more suitable for a one or two lot landscape.
And you were describing to me, since noble fir and mountain hemlock are adapted to an alpine situation, they are really slow growing, so they don't dominate a landscape the way if you planted a grand fir or a Douglas fir the way they would here.
Yes, and the reason I suggest conifers because they have cover year-round, and if you plant them close together, it provides shelter as well as food sources.
There are lots of different layers in the landscape. You've got your trees, and then, as you were describing, you have to be really sensitive to what your neighbor's needs are, too, in a small lot, and not plant something that's going to overshadow their garden.
Yes.
Yeah.
They will appreciate your consideration.
Yeah.
Native willows are an excellent host for butterfly larvae and other insects. For seeds, you can plant our native birch and vine maple. For a nut tree, the hazelnut is a good choice. some medium-sized trees that can provide both nectar and fruits are Pacific crabapple, bitter cherry, and cascara. Some deciduous shrubs for nectar and fruits are serviceberry, twinberry, osoberry, ninebark, and, of course, red flowering currant.
Also, like the red and blue elderberry, right? I've got a ton of red elderberry that the birds seem to love.
Yes. And remember, all our shrubs, if the conditions are right, they get to be quite large. So you
small
may
trees.
Want to go to
they
the trouble to see
trees.
How they're doing in your neighbor's yard or out in the wild so you have an understanding of how much space they need.
The elderberries are true small trees in my landscape, but I have the room for it.
Some other plants I can mention are for attracting Audubon's warblers. You can plant a large evergreen Pacific Bay berry, formerly known as wax myrtle. It's an excellent evergreen shrub. It has waxy seeds that have a lot of fat content, which is welcomed by birds in the winter. And then an excellent evergreen shrub with nectar-bearing flowers and edible fruits is the evergreen huckleberry.
It's a beautiful plant. I mean, it's an all-around stellar plant for beautiful foliage and great flowers, and the berries are yummy and they're good for humans to eat too, and they're retained all the way through December oftentimes, right?
It's a slower growing shrub, so there's usually opportunities to have space for it, and it can take quite a bit of sun, but it will also grow in partial shade. I don't want to fail to mention salal. It has nectar fruits and is great cover for small birds. It's good nesting cover for
birds. And it's beautiful, too. I mean, it was one of the...
Yes, it's evergreen.
Yeah.
It's used in the floral trade because it is so attractive. It does spread by stolen, so you should plant it where mowing or some other suitable barrier will keep it from getting into your perennial flower beds or vegetable garden.
And then we've got a layer of forbs, too, of some of the annuals and perennial forbs.
There are many native flowers that are beneficial to wildlife. I'll name a few that provide insects and nectar and seeds. They are fireweed, columbine, camas, bleeding heart, paintbrush, and hummer nettle, which is also known as coastal nettle.
And, you know, I don't know that plant very well because you were saying it's like a wetland species, right?
Well, it grows in moist, semi-shaded situations, and you will encounter it in riparian areas in the mountains.
And it's way different than a stinging nettle or a hedge nettle.
Yes, it's a botanist classified in a different family. It is a different plant. It doesn't sting.
So what's your feeling about bird feeders to supplement naturally available food? And I know this can be a controversial topic.
Bird feeding has introduced a lot of people to bird watching and created interest in birds. I could only speculate on the positive or negative effects on the birds. However, if you have bird feeders, you can help birds with their other requirements for cover, nest sites, and a variety of foods by enhancing their habitat in your landscape.
Enhancing habitat is always best. And if people want to feed birds, Wild Bird Unlimited is a great place to get advice on what kinds of feeders and what kind of food. But the critical thing is if you decide to feed, that you have to keep those feeders clean. They can be an amazingly bad thing for birds as a vector for disease.
Well, there are two common diseases noticed at feeders, salmonosis, which is a bacterial disease, and I believe it's a viral disease, is avian pox. Think about going to a restaurant and you will realize the importance of cleaning your feeders. Very important to avoid disease spread is the removal of fallen seed from below the feeders where it mixes with bird droppings.
And in our climate, it gets moldy and then it attracts rats and it's just a mess all the way around.
Aspergillosis is a fungal disease that birds can pick up from eating moldy feed. Should you observe sick birds at your feeder, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, they recommend you remove your feeders for a while. Then you should clean them with a 10% bleach solution.
And another really important thing, especially if you're keeping a bird feeder, is to keep its location safe from cats. This might be a good time to mention that one of the best things that you can do for your wildlife population is keep your cats indoors.
Some sampling of observed bird kills by domestic cats has been extrapolated out for the millions of free-roaming cats in North America. This has led to an astounding calculation of over 100 million birds killed annually by cats. It may be another reason why our bird chorus gets a little quieter every spring.
Yeah, actually, I think I read a report that it was in the billions of birds that were taken. Like, I was just astounded, like 3.7 billion. But anyway, lots and lots of birds that cats take.
A good solution, I think, is to create an outdoor cat room where your cat is restrained by screening but can otherwise enjoy the outside air. You can provide it with perches, scratching post, catnip toys, and other entertainments. You can have a small cat door in a window so the cat can come and go at will. I've seen where people hung a bird feeder close to the cat room, not too close. The cats also enjoy watching birds.
Yeah, that's right. Speaking of food, what about favorite foods for our insect friends, especially bees and butterflies?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, native plants may be the best source for hosting native insects. Introduced honeybees are drawn to many kinds of flowering plants. Native insects, I've already mentioned willows and fireweed. Willows are often host to a number of our native butterflies that we see in our area. Nectar-bearing flowers, both native and introduced, will feed many adult butterflies. But for the larva, the caterpillar stage of our butterflies and moths, which are necessary for bats, native plants are the most likely to be suitable. And this is partly because the caterpillars can or will only eat plants for which they're adapted.
Sometimes we forget how important our insects and spiders are, both as food for those beloved birds and bats, but also as pollinators, decomposers, and predators on other harmful pests. So what can we do to make our backyards more insect and spider friendly?
Well, besides adding native plants to our landscape, the other critical part of invertebrate habitat is dead wood in the form of tree snags, small logs, brush piles, and leaf and twig mulch. Using leaves and twigs as a mulch around your trees and shrubs, it can support an array of bugs and spiders. And here you'll see the sparrows, song sparrow, fox sparrow, golden crown sparrow, the spotted towhee, hermit thrush, robins, and varied thrush digging through the leaf litter, finding these insects and worms. You can also leave your flowers with their stalks over winter. This will provide insect eggs to birds hunting food in the winter. And it also may be where your favorite butterfly is surviving in a cocoon to be a butterfly.
Those snags and downed logs and piles of brush are a great resource.
I wanted to add one more thing. Many beetles eat fungus, and the fungus needs the decaying wood, and the beetle or their larva need the fungus. And They end up becoming food for the small mammals and birds.
It's all connected. We got off track a little bit, but I wanted to talk about how important it is for people not to use pesticides in their landscape just because of it running through the whole life cycle of animals. People don't realize what they do when they put pesticides down.
Yes, if there's an extreme case, like powder post beetles are eating your house, that may warrant pesticides, but you don't want to use something that persists in the soil so that we end up with it concentrated in our tissues like DDT was. So you should try to, if you have to use a pesticide, use the least toxic you can. If you have pests on your plants, try to tolerate them. While we're talking about pesticides, I'd like also to mention rat poison. There's evidence that the anticoagulants in rat poison is moving from sick rats into owls, hawks, and vultures, and even pets. So please avoid rat poison.
Yeah,
using
it's
rat
a
poison.
Dreadful thing.
What you can do instead is ensure if you have an outdoor compost that is barricaded against entry. Keep that closed. Keep that in a barrier that rats can't get into. On your house and other buildings, don't plant vines or have large shrubs right next to the house, because rats can crawl up those, and if you don't have hardware cloth over the vents in your soffit, they will gnaw through like plastic vent screen. They'll gnaw right through that, and then they're in your house. I wouldn't plant any large plants right next to my house. Keep your plants small next to your house.
And something else that people are phobic about is moles in their yard.
We should call a halt to the war on moles. They're beneficial animals. They enrich the soil, they fill it up, and they aerate the soil. They allow penetration by water into the soil. And they're helping your lawn, actually, because they're eating grubs that eat the roots of your grasses. So consider them friend and show some toleration. You can rake up that soil and add it to your garden. It's better than any soil
you can
buy. You
don't have to dig it up. That's right. Well, we have run out of time for today. I'm so sorry. But the good news is that we are going to be returning with Ron Sykes to talk about wildlife habitat in part two next month. Thanks so much for joining us, Ron.
You're welcome, Deborah.
We also have a bunch of great upcoming natural history events to tell you about. And they're all occurring around the weekend, so you'll have some tough choices to make.
Our local chapter of the Washington Native Plant Society is hosting a work and welcome to spring party on February 24th from 10 to noon. Meet at the Port Townsend Golf Course parking area with your work gloves and a small weeding tool in hand.
Then on Saturday, February 25th, come to the Dungeness River Audubon Center outside of Squim for a nest box building class from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. I can testify to the fact that this is a great class, as I took it last year and built a beautiful box for small owls. Following this class, starting at 2 p.m. in Port Angeles, there is a special event titled Food Webs Can Be Fishy, which talks about the importance of forage fish to seabirds and includes activities and hands-on demonstrations for both kids and adults.
Then on Sunday morning, February 26th, there's a field trip driving the loop from Woods Road to the Palo Alto Road looking for wintertime woodland birds. Go to the OlympicPeninsulaAudubon.org for more information on all of these, especially for the nest building class, which you should pre-register for ASAP to make sure that they have enough materials on hand.
The Jefferson Land Trust Geology Group is also sponsoring a lecture on Saturday, February 25th, starting at 4 p.m. at the Quimper Unitarian Fellowship Hall. The topic is The Bridge of the Gods and the Bonneville Landslide, one of Washington State's largest and youngest landslides. And here's our mystery sound again. It's a song sparrow, and it was Ron's choice. So, Ron, why did you choose it?
For whatever reason, I love the sound of the song. It's one of the earliest in the spring, which always picks you up. And the song sparrow is in our landscape almost every day. It's a lot of places I visit. And it just has a lot of character, the song sparrow.
They are sprightly. They're kind of like the Pacific Wren. They're always around, and they just make you happy
to hear them
and see them.
I've never seen one depressed.
And their song is really variable, and so is their plumage. I read that there were like 30 subspecies of song sparrows, but something that seems to stay constant is the wide gray eyebrow. They always seem to have that, and sometimes they get a dark spot on their breast. They get a streaky breast, and sometimes it turns into kind of a dark spot right in the middle of their chest. What else?
Well, here we have one of the more colorful, richer, reddish, deeper color. If you go to eastern Washington in a riparian area where you would see a song sparrow, they're more drab.
Well, they're a great bird and a great one for you guys to pay attention to. So that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the third week of February. Thanks so much for joining me, Ron, and thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of the program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. As always, happy trails.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.